However you might be listening across this community radio spectrum, you're tuned into the show that always recognised Julian Assange as a rock star before he was even added as a headline act for Splendour in the Grasp. It's The Fourth Estate, the weekly program that delves into the murky depths of our public face of communications. Mick Cordwell, along with you as always, over the next half hour. And today we find out that the UK decided to scrap an ad campaign, and it's all because you're worth it. And amidst all this speculation and rumours about the future of the retailer in the face of a mighty online giant, we uncover another initiative that's launched itself into the public eye in the nick of time to inspire a little bit more confidence in this David Jones versus Goliath battle. So stay with me over the next half hour for these stories, and coming up next, the idea of trust when it comes to the public sphere. Following a report detailing our shifting perceptions that we uphold in terms of trust in the media, in the wake of the ongoing phone hacking scandal, an online survey by Essential Research showed a definite slump in trust across most of the Australian commercial media bodies. In particular, local papers, commercial television and radio news showed the worst results in the polls. What was also noted was the dramatic rise in people admitting to have no trust at all within commercial media bodies. While the Australian Broadcasting Corporation maintained and even improved on its level, one in two of those surveyed revealed that they are now casting further doubts on the local media after the revelations of the scandal involved within Murdoch's tabloid News of the World. Bernie Keane is a seasoned expert as well as a trusted reporter on Crikey. So Dylan Barber spoke to him about the place and indeed the notion of trust in a modern media landscape.
Australia has arguably always maintained a level of scepticism towards the media, but the recent News of the World scandal has brought the issue to the forefront of discussion, and the Essential Report has highlighted a comprehensive fall in trust across all commercial media in Australia. What do you think is behind this deepening scepticism and slump in trust?
I think there's a couple of things at work. One, I suspect, despite the fact that I can't sort of back it up with statistical evidence, that coverage of the election played a role. In the 2010 election played a role in people's alienation or disengagement from the media. Okay. Perhaps not so much because of the quality of the coverage. I thought the quality of the media coverage of the election was actually very poor. But I think possibly because the one of the big factors at play was the actual, you know, the poor nature of what we were getting from politicians. I think in a sense there's a shoot the messenger sort of phenomenon at work there, because of the what everyone agrees, even politicians agree, was just an absolutely wretched political campaign.
Yeah.
And the media had no choice but to cover it, and that may have encouraged alienation. But look, I do think phone hacking has played a role. It is interesting that the biggest fall in trust was for commercial television news and current affairs. But that is the sector in Australia which is the most competitive and the sector that is the most tabloid. I mean, I suspect what we're seeing is a reaction to the broader sense of disgust that's emerged from the UK about obviously what's going on there.
Now, in your articles, you did note that the shift has not been from, you know, for example, some trust to a little trust, but towards no trust at all. How important is trust in the relationship between the media and the general population?
Well, it's more of a civic sort of thing. I mean, people will still consume the media. It may, you know, alienation from the media, lack of trust may exacerbate existing trends. I mean, I suspect if people don't trust newspapers, then they're not gonna go back to buying newspapers if they stop buying them. Newspapers in Australia are facing, not quite as apocalyptic a scenario as newspapers in the US, but clearly they are losing readers, and they're losing them sort of fairly consistently. So lack of trust is not going to help on that score. But look, people are still going to consume television and radio. So So it's not going to have perhaps a direct commercial impact.
Right. Now, you mentioned, obviously, you know, journalists are never very high, for example, on, you know, the Reader's Digest list of trusted professions. And, you know, this year we only beat taxi drivers, real estate agents, car salesmen, politicians and telemarketers. Mm. You know, is there an inherent level of distrust that will never be kicked?
Oh, look, absolutely. Like, I think people are always going to have... people are always going to dislike... if not dislike, then they're not really respect or like journalists as a profession. Everyone, I think, well, certainly everyone who sort of consumes the media regularly knows that there are good journalists, and everyone has their favourite journalists. Everyone has journalists whose work they would trust and have a very high level of faith in. But that's by way of contrast with a sort of more generic attitude toward the media, which is to regard the media as, you know, sensationalists, you know, only interested in money, only interested in sort of hyping things as much as possible. I think the journalists are stuck with that problem. And the only thing they can really do is work within a sort of a framework in which they try and operate ethically, and they try and produce as high quality journalism as they are allowed to by the people who pay them and by the people who edit them.
Yeah. Now, this is a current topic, obviously, but one online comment on your article said simply, despite the poll, I think the trust was lost long ago. What's your response to that?
Look, I'm not sure that's really fully the case. I think we're talking about a very complex social phenomena here. I think we are... If you go through that, he's obviously articulating a problem that everyone is aware exists, and yet it's inordinately complex to try and identify what started when and who was responsible, because you're dealing with, not merely with a problem on the part of politicians, but you're dealing with a problem on the part of the media at a senior level, and you're dealing with a problem with the media at the sort of practitioner, journalist level, and you're dealing with a problem with audiences. I mean, there has been a great sort of switch off of, a great decline in interest in public affairs in certain sections of the media. Yep. Over the last 20 years. But, it's only since the 1990s that we've had the sort of complex media environment that we've now got. I mean, up until the mid-1990s, we really only had TV, newspapers and radio as our key sources of information. And I reckon, and there's, again, I've got no evidence for this, but I reckon levels of trust in those different that much narrower range of media might have been higher, simply because there was that was all you got back then, and there wasn't this sort of, you know, there wasn't an entirely new and different media that constantly critiqued what the old media were doing.
Now, in the Essential report, the ABC fared pretty well, and they found that they'd retained and even gained trust. What's the significance of this considerable credibility gap between public broadcasting and the commercial media?
Well, obviously for anyone who's working in commercial media, it should be deeply worrying. Maybe it isn't worrying to a lot of people, but the issue is when we have this strong public broadcasting sector in Australia, there is therefore a yardstick for audiences to measure the performance of the commercial media by, and it's quite clear that people think they don't measure up. And I think to an extent the reason why there is this big gap there is because the resourcing of quality journalism is taken seriously by the ABC, and it's not taken quite as seriously in other parts of the commercial media.
The report also showed an 8% fall in trust for news and opinion websites, which of course includes Crikey, so what are you guys doing wrong?
Well, that's a very sort of interesting issue for us. I mean, really, there's not too many in Australia. The news and opinion online news and opinion site or market is actually quite small. It's hard for me to sort of comment on this without sounding like I'm biased one way or the other. I think there is a real problem with sites that are exclusively opinion sites, because what they're not offering ultimately is high quality analysis. And once you sort of reinforce the glut of opinion on the internet, it may be that it's in a sense sort of turning people off. It's not giving people what they want, which is the sort of analysis that they're not going to get elsewhere, and analysis that they frequently don't get from the mainstream media, because A lot of journalists and editors are just too resource constrained to provide it.
And I guess the most important question remaining now is, how can the Australian media regain this trust?
Well, look, I think the answer to that is actually sort of bound up in how they go forward with their business models. I mean, it is only through provision of quality journalism that you're ever going to regain people's trust. I mean, you can't regain it by dumbing down. You can't regain it by being ever more tabloid or being ever more sensationalist. You can try to regain it by offering high quality journalism that people can't get from opinion sites. So it's there's a basic tension now at work, I think, between the level of trust that people are demonstrating that they've got in the media and the media's concern to try and preserve its business model. I think the more that they de-resource quality journalism, the more downward pressure there's going to be on trustworthiness.
Bernard Keane writes for Crikey, as well as offering up his own two cents in the media debate around issues of trust. And he was speaking there to the new recruit for the Fourth Estate, Dylan Barber. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Fourth Estate, which is funded by the Humanities and Social Sciences Department at the University of Technology Sydney, alongside the Faculty of Arts at Macquarie University. In Australia, longer-lasting sex created public outrage. But in the United Kingdom, even Pretty Woman Julia Roberts has been banned from the billboards. Julia and former supermodel Christy Turlington found themselves on the chopping block after fronting two ad campaigns for cosmetic giant L'Oreal, spruiking their latest in anti-aging cosmetics. But the stringent industry codes in the UK, which governed by the Advertising Standards Authority, referred to codes for misleading advertising and exaggeration. But it's a different story here, with practically everyone going under the airbrush and Photoshop. Self-regulation of advertising means that these kind of decisions require a mass public outcry to eventually be ruled by the Standards Bureau. Yvonne Miller is a social psychologist at the Queensland University of Technology, and she explains to the Fourth Estate's Annie Wiley about why airbrushing may or may not be cause for concern.
The issue of body image and the media has long been apparent. Where do you stand on this banning of airbrushing images?
I think it's really important. So I, even though I'm often against banning things, I'm for banning airbrushing.
And why is that?
I think it just sends an unrealistic image and message to young people, particularly young girls, when they see, you know, these thin models who look very glamorous and extremely skinny, and that we don't even realise that they're airbrushed. You know, and people pick up these magazines and they consume them and they see these images and they don't realise that they're not obtainable.
We're told airbrushing is decreasing in portrayal of people in the media. Is it actually?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to say because we don't really track any statistics on this. I think advertisers and magazines and the media are much more aware of these issues than they ever have been before. And so I think previously there might have been a tendency to, we need to airbrush out that wrinkle or that little piece of cellulite. I think they're more conscious that when they do that, that might be the wrong thing to do.
What about the idea that not only is it setting a bad image for people, but it's perhaps false advertising and portraying a product that doesn't actually do what it's saying they do?
I mean, I hate to say it, but isn't that what advertising is all about? advertising is about selling a dream, you know, and that's what they say when they say that they're airbrushing it to make it look better because they're trying to sell an image and a lifestyle and a look. And actually, I have no problem with that, but we need to be honest about it. And that's why I'm glad we're having this conversation, because we need to remind ourselves when we see these images that they're not real.
Okay, so airbrushing is bad.
Yes.
But we still allow people who have had plastic surgery or Botox to, you know, appear on covers of magazines or in adverts. Are they comparable? Are they the same thing?
I don't think they're the same thing. I mean, I think they're probably degrees of the same issue. I think that's an interesting point. I think we've all seen good and bad cosmetic surgery and good and bad Botox and the impact. And, you know, I don't know. I don't have a simple answer for that. I mean, I would preferably, I would like to be in a world where if there was any kind of artificialness, you know, that required surgery or airbrushing, it had to be declared. And I don't know if we're there yet.
The recent pictures in two L'Oreal adverts of Julia Roberts and Christy Turlington were legally banned from being used by the UK's advertising body, the Advertising Standards Authority. But is there the opportunity to take this sort of definitive, decisive action in Australia?
I haven't seen that here. I think that the time's right for it. I think that we're talking about these kind of things, and I think it would be a wonderful thing if it did happen, if we actually, if we stood up and said as a society that no, we want to be honest in our advertising and truly honest, so that we're going to ban airbrushing.
So the way that the advertising industry is currently operating in terms of self-regulation,
yep,
is perhaps not the best way for Australian advertising to be going?
I mean, that's a difficult one because they would say, and I would agree, they are getting a lot, lot better. But I think we have to be really clear that unless things are against the law, then there's always going to be people who do them. Do you know what I mean? Like, we need to actually, that's why we have laws, to set standards about what's appropriate and not appropriate in our society. And so if we believe that, you know, airbrushing is wrong and inappropriate, and we want to take a stronger stand about it, then maybe we do need a law.
Do you think that harsher regulations would limit perhaps the creativity of the industry?
It's not about limiting creativity, it's about being realistic about people's bodies. So I think those are two very different arguments. You know, we all know when we see a flying car or, you know, a orange alligator that's jumping 10 feet in the air, we know that that's creative and we know that that's not real. You know, we know that that's not, you know, that's not something you see in day-to-day life. But we don't know that when we see, you know, women's bodies and faces that have been airbrushed, like, because they're represented as being real. So I think there is a difference between that, and I think it's not about regulating creativity or saying don't be creative. It's about, well, let's just be a little bit honest and realise that advertising has impact beyond what the advertiser thinks it does.
Do you think that there's a spectrum of appropriateness in terms of airbrushing, for instance, removing things from a background of a picture or changing clothing on a model is all right, but changing someone's face isn't?
I would agree with that. I believe that there are degrees of what is appropriate. I think those first things that you mentioned, they don't change the intent or the, you know, they don't misrepresent something. You know, it's difficult. I mean, we're getting into the grey area, and that's where it becomes quite challenging. And I guess it's about professionals, and that's the designers and the artists and the photographers and the models and everybody having a conversation about what we think is appropriate and not appropriate.
Speaking there to Annie Wiley, Yvonne Miller is a social psychologist at QUT. And don't forget, if you ever miss a show, you can subscribe to our podcast. Head along to 4thestate.podomatic.com. In recent months, there's been a lot of bad news about the closure of retail chains, especially bookshops. The rise of online discounters and e-readers is making life hard for the booksellers, especially the small independent stores. But they're fighting back with a new campaign about to be launched called IndieBound. It's a new publicity scheme promoting shopping at small local businesses, which include Bookshop. John Page is the president of the Australian Booksellers Association. He says the IndieBound campaign is all about choosing diversity over the shopping mall experience. He spoke with Louise Brooks.
The bookstores aren't facing any unique challenges at the moment. I think all retail is facing challenges at the moment, and the consumers are changing the way they buy and the way they spend money at the moment, and that's a big challenge, whether you're selling books or socks or glasses or whatever it is. So it's not a unique thing to the book industry. And yes, there's one big chain that has gone, but there's some fantastic things going on in lots of other bookshops around the country, both independent bookshops and chain bookshops as well. There's some fantastic things that Collins Booksellers are doing. We just had our 87th annual Booksellers Conference down in Melbourne, and the mood of the conference was really positive, and there were some really fantastic announcements that we had throughout the conference of initiatives and things that are going on to help booksellers and help get the message out there to people that bookshops are here to stay.
And can you tell us some of the benefits for consumers to shop at an Australian-owned bookstore?
Well, the benefits are that an Australian-owned bookshop cares about the Australian book industry. So, you know, yes, you can go and find the latest international blockbuster at your local bookshop, but your local bookshop will also be able to tell you about the next crop of fantastic Australian writers that are out there, people like Chris Womersley and Fable Parrott, who, you know, people like Amazon are not going to tell you about those authors, but your local Australian-owned bookshop is going to tell you all about that next generation of fantastic writers that you might not have discovered if you'd just gone to an international bookshop.
Are there many differences between what an independently owned bookshop can offer and, say, an Australian-owned or an Australian chain?
There are some differences. I mean, an independent bookshop has a bit more flexibility in what they stock and on what their stock range is. But in saying that, a lot of the chain stores are franchise-owned as well. I think that was one of the things that got missed in the kind of the news about Red Group's collapse, was that the Angus and Robertson chain was actually made up of a number of franchise stores. So these franchise stores are very similar to independents. They're owned by you know, local people. They're small businesses that are run just for the proprietor. They're not a head office run store. They're not run by an office in Melbourne or Sydney. They're run by the someone who lives in the local community. So there's some parallels between independents and franchise bookshops. But you know, independents is just it's the creativity and passion, and they control all aspects of their bookshop. So you know when you go into an independent bookshop that every book in that shop has been personally chosen by the owner of that bookshop and not dictated by someone sitting in an office somewhere else. So that's the real power of an independent bookshop.
I've heard about the IndieBound campaign. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, IndieBound was the other initiative that we launched at the conference. IndieBound was started by the American Booksellers Association, and we were lucky enough to have for our opening keynote speech at the conference Becky Anderson, who's the president of the American Booksellers Association, came out here and one of the aspects that she told us about was IndieBound, and we've just launched it here in Australia, indiebound.org.au. And IndieBound is not just about independent bookshops; it's about independent businesses in general. It's a movement celebrating and highlighting the benefits of having independent businesses in your community, and how that gives you a diverse range of shops, and you know, it gives you a nice place to go shop. No one wants to go to kind of a shopping mall or a high street where all the shops are identical and all selling the same products that the next suburb over. You know, people want a diverse range of shops and places to visit. And independent online retail and people kind of spending more money overseas, it's great to be able to highlight to customers what the benefits are of actually shopping in your local bookshop. It means money stays in a local community. It means it's jobs for that local community. So it's a real local movement. And it starts in a bookshop, but it spreads to all those independent businesses that make up that community that the bookshop exists in.
So there are similarities or advantages for the local butcher, the local sort of baker, that kind of those
Definitely.
Sorts of shops?
And I think there's already some movements already in Australia like that, and there's lots of really great business alliances and local kind of chamber of commerce that already do these things in their local communities. And IndieBound is just about kind of giving them more information and more stuff to be able to communicate the message that's going on, or if that movement isn't happening in an area, getting it started, and it's spreading the word, and yeah, getting the independent butcher involved and the independent baker and all kind of working together, because you know a bookshop's only as good as the shops around it, and so there's already a relationship there, so it's about working together and spreading a positive message about what it means to spend money in your local community.
John Page from the Australian Booksellers Association speaking there to Louise Brooks. And for more info about the campaign, head along to the website indiebound.org.au. Doesn't time fly when you're having fun? That wraps up another week on the Fourth Estate. Thanks so much for tuning in. Show your support for the program by dropping us a line at fourthestate@2ser.com. Find out the latest trending topics within the media industry. Follow Fourth Estate Radio on Twitter. I'm Mick Caldwell. Until next week, I hope you take care.